Blog Talk Radio. Blog Talk Radio.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. Get up.
Hello, I'm Kay Thompson, and this is Gus Henneberg sitting here with me, and welcome to Kay Thompson and Gus Henneberg Taking a Closer Look. How are you, Gus?
I'm fine, thank you, and I'm happy to be here.
And we're going to be talking, as a matter of fact, what's going to be happening
tonight?
On Kay and Gus' show, as we take a closer look at our topic, is that we are going to be telling people that we are sponsored by Black Wax. Moving images. And we're going to be talking about that a little later on in the program, because we're going to give you the whole real deal about Black Wax. By the way, we are in the Black Wax studios in Jersey City.
Now,
emphasize
Jersey City, because those people in New York will assume if it's a first-class operation, it's in New York. So make it clear, we're in Jersey City in the studio.
Make sure everybody hears that. Jersey City, New Jersey, everyone. Black Wax. Black Wax. And the wax is spelled W-A-X-X, and you're going to hear a lot more about that. Also, if you really want somebody to do your documentaries, your TV programs, your radio programs, etc., Black Wax with Ty Washington, Ayanna Jones, and Shauna Glover. Boy, I'm sorry. Ataki, you know, they're all here, and we're really very glad to be here. I'm surprised. Look at this studio. This is absolutely fantastic. We even have Bob Marley playing. Well, listen, everyone, we just want to tell a little bit about, you know, some of the events that, you know, we were attending. We went down to New Jersey Performing Arts Center. There was a tribute going on for Larry Goldman down there, because where is he going? What is he doing?
Well, let me back up a bit. Larry was the first executive director of the Performing Arts Center. Mm-hmm. And has been there for 20-some-odd years. He is now leaving, but he's not going anywhere.
Uh-huh.
He is going to build a new building right across the street from the existing Performing Arts Center, which will be for housing for artists and so on.
Mm-hmm.
So he is leaving his long-term tenure as executive director of an institution that everybody said would fail.
Yeah, yeah.
And, of course, it didn't fail.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he is leaving as executive director, but he will still be intimately involved in the continued growth of the Performing Arts Center.
We're so glad to hear that he is going, because he's such a part of, you know, that whole area downtown Newark. It really is fantastic, downtown in Newark, New Jersey, right, guys?
Even at night,
yeah. A lot of people, you know, we did the show with the former governor, Tom King, and when we started doing the video portions of the program along with the radio show, we're going to be talking about that again, and also about how you had your construction people. They had to have a diversified construction staff and crew, because they hadn't had diversified construction crews before in building buildings downtown Newark or any place else in the state of New Jersey. Am I right?
And the state of New York.
Uh-huh. But downtown Newark, they use a completely diversified construction crew.
Correct.
And what did you do? I mean, did they put in a certain amount of man hours or what?
We basically took the position that if we didn't work, you don't work.
Yeah.
If your construction people want to build this building, you better go find some black plumbers and some black carpenters, mm-hmm, and some black bricklayers. And they did.
Yeah, and Latinos and women, I should say, also.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, why was that? Why was it so hard to have black people working in construction in New York and New Jersey?
It's very typical. New York and New Jersey are among the, in the construction industry. Mm-hmm. New York and New Jersey are among the most segregated entities in the entire United States.
Wow.
Historically. And we took a position that if we don't work, nobody works.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just the Performing Arts Center. It was Newark Airport. It was building after Rutgers Construction, Essex County College. And that's how we got the workforce integrated.
When you say we, that means your company, Gustav Henningberg Associates, because you were the affirmative action officer for the state of New Jersey?
No, I didn't work for the state of New Jersey.
Uh-huh.
They were the problem.
So how were you involved in that?
The people who were putting the buildings up said, Gus, can you take the steps that are necessary that we have an integrated workforce at Essex County College, at Rutgers, at New Jersey Performing Arts Center, and so on.
So that's how the black people, black workers, Latino workers, women came to work on the New Jersey Performing Arts Center.
And all of those other buildings I just mentioned.
Now, the same thing happened with you out at Newark Airport.
Correct.
You were responsible, really, in a large part, for desegregation of the airport. How?
Basically the same thing.
The same thing?
When they were expanding the airport, lots of construction, runways, hangars, buildings, and we took the same position. This is public money, and if you don't get some minority folk out here, we're not going to let you build it.
And so? That's when you stopped the airplanes from coming in to Newark Airport?
Well, we stopped them for a few minutes.
You stopped them. But anyway.
It didn't take long.
And we understand. We said before they escorted you off the runway.
Into jail. They have the Port Authority has a little jail right there on the airport.
Yeah.
And when I walked out on the runway, and this was a result of hours and hours and hours of trying to get somebody to talk to me, and they were not going to do it. And I had learned enough about airports to know that you can disrupt one very easily. And when there's a foreign object on the runway.
And you were the foreign object.
And I was the foreign. Every plane coming to Newark gets diverted to somewhere else. Those people that left Washington coming to Newark ended up in Pittsburgh. But it worked.
Yeah, it worked. All right. And now, what form did this action take for the airport, for desegregating the airport? For instance, what were some of the demands that you made?
I wanted minorities in the construction workforce.
On the airport, the asphalt.
On the airport.
The runway.
Buildings and painting and all that
all
stuff.
That.
There's a lot of construction on an airport.
Yeah.
I wanted minority concessionaires selling hot dogs and whatever. And I wanted minorities owning gift shops.
Yeah.
In other words.
Like duty-free shops.
There's a lot of business at an airport.
And blacks were kept out of those businesses. Is that it?
There had never been a black concessionaire in the history of Newark Airport.
Mm-hmm.
But now, let's make it clear. Nor at LaGuardia Airport. Nor at Kennedy Airport, nor at the Washington, D.C. Airport.
Wow.
Minorities had not focused on the that whole opportunity of concessions at an airport.
Okay, now let's jump ahead. I understand that since you went on the runway, you got the attention of whoever was running the place, meaning the Port Authority of New York, New Jersey. You went to Washington. They asked you, what kind of demands, what else do you want in order to, you know, keep this stuff down. We don't want this happening at the airport anymore, I'm assuming. So you also said at that particular time, I want black businesses or minority businesses. Tell us how that happened.
Well, it
what
all
kind
followed.
Of business?
By going out on the runway, it made very clear to the people who ran that airports are very vulnerable.
Yeah.
And you just send one person. You don't have to send a busload out on that runway.
Mm-hmm.
And every airplane coming your way has to get diverted to somewhere.
So that was your leverage then for desegregation. Also, what kind of businesses were there at the airport? There weren't any, but however, there were different how do you get the businesses together to go out to the airport to try to, you know, have their businesses out there?
Well, let's be more specific. An airport is more than just airplanes.
Yeah.
There are every kind of business out there you can imagine. There are hamburger stands, there are shoeshine stands, there are news stands, there are gift shops, there are in every airport.
Everything.
None of them, and they're the concessionaires, none of them at Newark Airport were minority owned.
Wow.
Not one.
Mm-hmm.
Nor at LaGuardia,
mm-hmm.
nor at Kennedy,
mm-hmm.
nor at Washington, D.C.
Or any other airport.
Nor at Baltimore.
Racism was full force.
Let me use the term, the civil rights movement had not found its way to the airport.
I see.
At that point.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we tried very hard through meetings, but we weren't getting anywhere. And it occurred to me one day that they're very vulnerable, but they don't,
quite fully appreciate it.
Yeah, yeah.
And the minute
I walked out on the runway, all of a sudden
two things happened.
He said,
he's crazy. Look at him. He's out there. There are airplanes coming in there. I was saying to myself, this is crazy.
Yeah.
I'm going home, get back in my bed.
But before you were able to do that, you were whisked off to jail.
Yes, they have a little jail right there on the runway.
Uh-huh.
Not on the runway, but right on the side of the runway.
Now, some of the businesses that you were represented or you got there, for instance, was there a shoeshine, you know, company?
There were two minority concessionaires at Newark Airport.
Concessionaires, you mean the duty-free?
Well, everybody selling a product out there is a concessionaire.
I see, okay.
But that's what they're called.
Mm-hmm.
There were two that were minority. One was a newsstand in the old Terminal A lobby.
Mm-hmm.
And people who've been around for a while will remember that before they built all the new buildings and so on. And the other was a shoeshine stand.
Yeah.
Those were the only minority businesses of the 116 businesses at Newark Airport.
Mm-hmm. And they couldn't get any traction or anything, I understand. So what happened? How did you get the other businesses to try to get out there?
Well, when you walk out on the runway, you get everybody's attention.
Including those people with businesses, those minority people with businesses.
No, well, they thought I was crazy.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And some of the white managers at the airport went to the minority concessionaires and said, is that a friend of yours out there? If it is, you better tell him to get off our runway.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And I had talked to them before I walked out there and mm-hmm. told them what I was going to do.
Oh, you did? You did?
Oh, yeah. I'm talking about the minority concessionaire.
Okay.
They
were
only two.
Uh-huh. And they really thought it. But that grew to being how many different businesses out there at Newark Airport because of your demands? Because your demands went all the way to Washington.
Well, when the...
So what are some of the other businesses?
Well, let me explain the Washington thing. Once it became clear that there was a set of people who were willing, at my suggestion, to walk out on the runway, it wouldn't be just me the next time. It might be me and 15 other people.
Yeah.
that's when the powers that be decided we've got to address this problem. Next thing we know, they'll be doing this at Atlanta Airport,
yeah.
Washington Airport, Chicago Airport, and so on. And we had a meeting.
You with the business people had a meeting.
Well, now let me finish this. I had a meeting at Newark Airport with the governor of New Jersey, the CEO of the Port Authority, who owns and operates the airport, and all of the other people who were involved.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And at that meeting, the airport manager said, Gus, we've got to go talk to the commissioner of transportation for the state of New Jersey. It's the federal government runs these airports.
Yeah.
So with the chairman of the New Jersey State Chamber of Commerce, who was then Don McNaughton, the CEO of Prudential Insurance Company, the governor of New Jersey, and four or five other very important people. We got on the shuttle one morning, flew to Washington, and met with the Secretary of Transportation and said, you got to fix this.
And they did fix it.
And they fixed it.
Okay, so now let's jump ahead to how many businesses then that came to be at Newark Airport?
I think about 20.
We do have to, you know.
About 24.
All right, that's 24. We're going to have to take a break right now, and then we'll come back. And then we're going to be talking about this one because we want to find out what businesses are there, and also we want to find out how you started Duty Free Airport, Black owned Duty Free Air concessionaires, right? Am I saying that correctly? All around the country. We'll be right back, everyone. Stay with us. I'm Kay Thompson with Gus Henningberg, and this is Kay and Gus taking a closer look. We'll be right back. Stay with us.
Who has hurt all mankind? Just a favorite home, believe me.
One love.
What about a war?
One heart.
What about a
let's get together and feel all right.
As it goes in the beginning.
One love.
Oh, shall it be in the end?
One heart.
All right. Is only I'm a Gideon.
One love.
When the man comes, there will be no do.
One love.
Have pity on those whose chances grow thin. There ain't no hiding place from the Father of creation. Hear ye?
One love.
All right, we are back. Kay Thompson here, Gus Henningberg here, and we are going to be continuing this conversation about the duty, not the day duty free, but the different businesses at Newark Airport and how Newark Airport, which is now, what's the name of the airport now, Newark what? Newark Liberty or Newark International?
Newark Liberty International Airport.
Newark Liberty International Airport, big airport. Is it one of the biggest in the country?
No.
No. What's the biggest one in the country, you think?
Kennedy
is bigger.
Yes.
Well, a lot of things are going on down there. I mean, that's one really very, very full airport. But anyway, we're going to be getting into that in another time, I would imagine. But I want to let people know that because of your action that you took, one of the businesses that you demanded be put in or be supported at Newark Airport was the duty-free concession. Is that it? Am I saying correctly?
The duty-free is a very lucrative profession at an airport.
Yeah.
The only people who can buy things in a duty-free store are people getting ready to get on an airplane.
Ah, they're getting ready to get on the airplane to fly.
Somewhere.
Internationally or what?
Wherever, but they can't. You can't walk in off the street.
And go
not be going anywhere and go buy your gifts and stuff at the duty-free store.
I see.
Duty-free means no tax.
Ah, okay.
That's what duty-free means. And so all the stuff that you buy at a duty-free store, it's a good price because you're not paying any tax on it.
Mm-hmm. So there are now duty-free concessions all around the country because of the action taken at Newark Airport. Is that correct?
The last time I checked, and it's been a while, there are probably 100.
Mm-hmm. And just to let those concessionaires know that it started in Newark, at Newark Airport. Amazing. Absolutely amazing.
Well, they know it. They are well organized. They mean the concessionaires.
Yeah, it's a fascinating business.
They now have not just duty free, all the concessionaires and newsstands, whatever. They have a conference every year. And they pick nice places to have these conferences. They don't meet on 125th Street.
Yeah, yeah. You know, because I want to talk about the students for a minute also, but before we did that, we did attend a few other events, but there's one I want to talk about. There was a street in East Orange, New Jersey. It was named for the principal of Jackson Academy in East Orange, New Jersey, and I'd like to say congratulations to Gladys M. Calhoun, because the street was named for her. Gladys Calhoun Way, Gladys M. Calhoun Way, and Jackson Academy is an extraordinary school. It really is an extraordinary school. Also, Juneteenth is coming up, and it's going to be a rodeo, and guess where? Elizabeth, New Jersey.
Oh, there are lots of horses and things like that in Elizabeth. That's an appropriate place.
Anyway, getting back to something about education, we were talking about, so many different things happening downtown Newark, but downtown Newark is a center for higher education. And we had a young lady on with us some time ago, and her name is Millie Harris. And she, her other name as an author is Milagros Milan, and she is an extraordinary teacher, and we know that. Now, aside from being the author, by the way, Millie, welcome once again to A Closer Look.
I'm so glad to be here again. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here. Now, the name of your book is
The Tales from the Underground Diva Lounge.
Okay. And people have been calling about that, and people have been, talking about that book. We're going to get into that, but there's something else going on with social justice with you.
Right.
So I'm going to but we have a call. So let's get to the call. Hello, you're on the air. Hello, you are on the air.
Can you hear me?
I can't hear you.
Hello? You hear me now? You hear me?
Can't hear them. Trying.
Okay. Hello, hello.
Call isn't coming through to me.
Hello?
I hear you. I hear you outside somewhere, but I can't hear you right now. That comes through to me, Mike.
Hello. Hello.
Anyway, as soon as we get this problem, we'll come back to them. So the caller will hold on. We'll try to come right back. Okay. But Millie Harris, extraordinary teacher.
Well, thank you.
One of the most extraordinary teachers I've talked to. You and Angela and Leon and Angela Christmas, who's here also, Leon Owens down there in Princeton, and doing things that really are making a difference. Now, aside from your being an author, and with the most hilarious book I've ever read in my life, by the way.
I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Yeah. You're an extraordinary teacher, and you are teaching. What do you teach over there at Central High School in Newark?
Well, first of all, let me take this opportunity to brag about Central High School.
Okay.
Because Central High School was one of the schools that was considered to be a failing school. We were able to procure funds from the school improvement grants for $5 million and now are considered a turnaround school. Our scores went up this year exponentially.
Wow.
Which is a testament to the hard work of the faculty, the administration, the staff. I think this was an effort that took everybody, and particularly the children, who really just rose to the occasion and exceeded all expectations. And I say kudos to the kids.
Yeah.
They did a great job.
Kudos to the staff also.
Thank you very much. We did work hard.
Yeah, I know.
We had
a love of children. Yeah, really. No
kidding. For the first time ever.
What does that mean, an extended day?
An extended day meant that part of the grant money, that we had to add two periods to the day. So normally our school day for the student to end at 2:40, it was extended to about 4:15.
No kidding. How did that happen? How did the students react to that?
Initially, not so well.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't easy. It was a difficult task to get the kids to really just stay in the building. They had been offered certain extracurricular activities by the time, the program had to be put together very quickly, and not everything was in place. But in spite of that, the one thing that did come out of it, it allowed our third year, our junior students, to participate in a HESPA academy.
Okay. And you can explain that in a minute. I have to say this year, I've been to Central High School at your invitation. Ras Baraka, you did not invite me. Anyway, Millie did. And your classes are extraordinary. They
They
are interactive.
Right.
The students are, they don't know what you're going to do next.
No, they have no
And
idea.
You teach with such a unique way that the kids want to be there because they want to see what you're going to do next
right.
and what you're going to say next.
Right.
You allow them such freedom, and at the same time, you pull them together. They're absolutely fascinated with you. I've never seen a teacher like you.
Oh, thank you. That is really great.
Really, and I've taught
really
school, you know, I've
right,
taught,
know.
You know, for a number of
I
years
know.
In Newark
That's
and
right.
William Patterson, et cetera, et cetera. But you have that knack of the love for those kids, and they know it.
I think that's where it comes from.
Yeah,
you
and they know it.
You have to really, you know, teachers are overworked, underpaid, undervalued, and I don't think you can go to a place
yeah.
every single day and start fresh and keep it exciting unless it really matters to you.
Okay.
It has to come from the heart. It certainly doesn't come for that paycheck.
Well,
it's barely enough to live.
There's so many things happening in your
yes.
classroom that, you know, it's just, I always want to come to see what's going to be going, what's
yes.
going to be going
and
on
we're
next.
Doing great things now.
I know.
Really great things.
Want to get to this. Want to get to this that you're teaching social justice.
We teach social justice.
Now,
the,
just let me introduce this because this is
okay.
so fascinating. People are going to be absolutely fascinated with it. You are now involved with the kids who, the experiences of kids whose parents are incarcerated.
Incarcerated.
What they go through.
Right.
What they go through. And we're going to find out exactly what your approach to this social justice is in just a minute because we do have a caller. And let's see if we can get him on the line right now, either him or her. Hello, you're on the air. You are on the air. Hello? Still can't. It's not coming through. So as soon as
Hello?
Get,
Hi, can you hear me?
Hello?
Hi, how you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm fine. This is Nana Sol, and I just want to say you guys have a wonderful show. I'm just so excited that the KANGA show is on.
I'm
Hello?
Sorry. Can't do that. We're still trying to work that out. And as soon as we do, we will. But anyway, getting back to you, Millie, the approach to social justice. These kids must go through a whole heck of a lot with the experience, and just experiences that they have when they go to you know, the jails,
right.
the prisons,
right.
to see.
Right.
The, so when you approach that, what happened? How did that happen? And
okay. Well, with Montclair State University on something called YPAR, Youth Participatory Action Research. This year was the
What
very
is that
first.
Called? Why?
YPAR. YPAR. YPAR.
Okay.
That's what we call it.
Okay.
Youth Participatory Action Research.
Okay.
And what that means is that children need to take agency in their own lives, in their own communities, and they know best about their experiences. So they get an opportunity to research and develop an action plan, present it, and see it through.
Mm-hmm.
This was the first year we did it. We had some degree of success. We went to a YPAR summit at Montclair State University with the students from Montclair High School.
What did that consist of?
That consisted of the two groups presenting issues that were of their concern. Our students brought, I would say, at least a dozen projects.
Mm-hmm.
They were able to present their projects in multimedia. They had made films. They had skits they did, interactive with their audience.
How did you get to the issue of the kids
and incarceration?
That
came out of the YPAR.
Okay.
Okay. This program, this youth participatory action research,
did the kids
has been
suggest
ongoing.
That? Did they suggest
well,
that topic?
Yes and no. And part of the reason that they did not overtly suggest it is the fact that incarcerated parents are the dirty little secret. Incarcerated family members are things that the kids do not necessarily openly talk about it, but they are experiences that they're going through in their personal lives. And sometimes they keep their pain to themselves. So when we were at Montclair State, we saw a YPAR project that had been done by Dr. Michelle Fine from NYU on something called Echoes of Incarceration. And it was children doing research and presenting a film about their experiences with the judicial system.
What were some of those experiences?
Well, you know, like kids talking about their homes being broken into in the middle of the night by the police, their parents taken away, you know, ending up in DIFAS, joining gangs because their parents were incarcerated and they really didn't have a support system. What happens when your parent is away and you're a kid who's an achiever?
Yeah.
Do you disassociate yourself, or are they still your loved ones? What about relationships? Do you visit your parents? Do you not visit your parents? These are and it's not just parents. Let me not just say parents, because it's siblings, it's uncles, it's extended family members. It's
in other words, these kids who are experiencing this have to go through a process when they go to visit, for instance,
of
their parents or, you know.
Of course. When you go to visit a person in prison, you're like a person who's in prison yourself.
Absolutely.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
And you know, seeing them for short periods of time, often having to travel great distances to see them.
All that inconvenience.
And now, as you and I have talked about privately, you know, with Congressman Payne looking at this issue of funding being families so that eventually these people won't even be able to afford to visit their loved ones.
Not at all.
Right.
Not
so
at
there
all.
Are some serious issues. Mm-hmm. So the Social Justice Academy, looking at that and examining the work of Michelle Alexander in a book entitled The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness.
And she is where?
She's out of Ohio State.
Out of Ohio State,
right.
Okay.
She was an ACLU attorney, now a professor, who really brought to light and really made it clear to everyone. She wrote a very clear and concise research piece, beautiful book, that explains, you know, our kids are being incarcerated at record rates.
Yeah.
They're going straight from high school to the penitentiary.
And that's the kind of thing that you're working on
and
now.
This is a movement around the country. Now, we have
trying to stop this movement from school to jail
for
minority communities.
For minority communities.
Absolutely.
And, of course, the escalating violence in New York, the gang violence, all of these things that are creating this cycle of hopelessness and despair. But unfortunately, people adapt to despair, so they really need to look at this with a critical eye.
When you started this, you know, talking to the students about this, you know, what was your reaction to that? Were you amazed? Were you, you know,
Yes and no.
How did you feel doing this?
I'm always moved by their stories, and I'm moved by their resilience.
Did they seem to want to talk about it?
Not initially. They're reserved initially, you know, when Michelle Fine did come to our school, actually yesterday, and spoke. And, you know, initially the kids will approach it with maybe a question here or there about them. And then eventually they move into questions about you.
Yeah.
And then finally when they start saying, you know,
my experience,
that's when you know it's hit home, and our kids are so incredibly involved and engaged. But I do have to tell you the other part of this.
Yes, go right ahead.
I have a personal friend who has been incarcerated for 23 years now. He was the third person in the country to receive a super kingpin statute, which carries the penalty of life without the possibility of parole. He's very well known in Newark. His name is Wayne Akbar Prey, and like I said, you know, I knew him back in the day.
He is presently incarcerated
for, you know, life with no parole. So anyway, long story short, I decided to reach out, and when I found him, I found that he was doing the same type of work inside the prison for years. For these years that he's been incarcerated, he's been working with young prisoners and increasingly younger and younger prisoners that are serving longer and longer sentences. Longer and longer sentences, and that are leaving the prisons more ill-prepared than ever.
For anything. They can't do anything.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And this is part of this caste system that's developing as a result of this mass incarceration of people of color.
Wow.
So in talking to Mr. Prey and realizing that what he was doing on the inside was very similar to the work that I'm doing on the outside as a teacher, and trying to engage the kids in, you know, some activities that are meaningful for them. And ultimately the goal that we decided to come to together was to work through his works that he's already established to get this message out to these kids long before they leave high school.
Has that been difficult for him to do, to get messages out into the community from where he is?
He has been amazingly resourceful.
Uh-huh.
He's published 2 books, uh-huh. a third in the works. He has an incredible CD entitled Akbar Prey Speaks to Urban America.
I see. Uh-huh.
His tale is a cautionary tale on many levels,
uh-huh.
and that's what he presents to the kids.
When he is involved with this, I mean, how is he treated in the prison?
He was a person who commanded a lot of respect
uh-huh.
outside of prison
uh-huh.
and inside of prison because of the work that he's doing, and that's from the institutions themselves because he has been doing very good work.
Okay, now this leads me to asking Gus about his experiences when you went to, was it Rahway or Trenton prison?
Rahway.
Now, what happened with that was that the prisoners wanted to get information out to the officials, and they called you down to negotiate, or what?
No, the prisoners rioted in Rahway Prison.
Mm-hmm.
Not long after the riots had got much more fame up at Attica
yeah.
in New York. In New York, the then governor, Rockefeller, sent troops in with guns and shot up a lot of people.
Yeah.
That happened in New Jersey a few months later. The then governor of New Jersey said...
The rioting happened. The shootings didn't go on in New Jersey, right?
No, I mean the problem in the prison.
Okay.
But the governor, the prisoners went on a strike. And the governor of New Jersey said, I'm not going to do what my friend, the governor of New York, did.
Who was the governor at that time? Was that Cahill?
Yes.
Okay.
He was going to approach the problem that Rockefeller had approached by shooting people up.
Mm-hmm.
He's going to try to find another way to do it. And that's how I got there. He called me and asked if I would go into the prison and help into Rahway, try to find out what the problems are, what can we do about it, and so on. Mm-hmm. So that's how I got there.
Yeah. Did the prisoners ask for you also, or what?
I don't know.
You don't know, but you went there. Did?
But I must admit.
Were you able to get what they wanted, you know, out to the governor and people or what?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the first question I got when I was being taken into the prison, because the prisoners who were rioting were all lined up against the cells.
Yeah.
Just trying to see what's going on out
mm-hmm.
there. And I came in and all of a sudden I hear, Gus. What are you doing here?
A lot of your friends in prison.
A lot of my friends are on the other side of the bar over there.
Uh-huh.
But we were able to negotiate a settlement at Rahway Prison, unlike what had happened in New York.
Mm-hmm. And what happened as a result? Did the officials go along with it or what?
Yeah.
Yeah? Okay. All right. Without any... killings or deaths or anything like that.
There was no rioting in the prison.
Prison personnel weren't listening to them then.
That was one of the problems.
Mm-hmm. Wow. That is something that the kids have to go through.
And let me make this other quick observation. There's a place about a half a mile south of Rahway Prison, a training facility.
Uh-huh.
And wardens of every other prison in New Jersey were at Rahway because it was the biggest of all of them.
Yeah.
And they were down in this place just south of Rahway Prison. Mm-hmm. And the governor was down there with them, and they were screaming, these wardens of other prisons were screaming at the governor, bring the state police in and shoot them.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And the governor was, all of his instincts said, I'm not going to do that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And these wardens were saying, they're not going to listen to you.
Mm-hmm.
They're not going to talk to you. And who is that pointing at me?
Mm-hmm.
I was not well known among the prisoners, the wardens in the prison in those days.
Mm-hmm.
But the governor stuck with it. And two or three other people and I went into, after being fully briefed, went into the prison, spent about 2 days talking and communicating and negotiating. and settled it with no shots being fired.
Yeah.
Nobody got killed at all in prison.
Mm-hmm. Okay. All right. We are running out of time. We're going to have to take a break, and we will come back. Again, Millie, we're going to be talking to you more about this and more about what your experiences are regarding this particular project, because it is something to, you know, we'll look at very, very seriously. So my name is Kay Thompson, and your name is?
Jess Hindenburg.
And your name is? Okay, we're going to come back, and who knows, maybe we will be able to get a call caller on the phone. The reason why we couldn't is because it's not coming through on the microphone, so please hang in there with us, everyone. We will be right back. Okay. Give me what number? And we are back, everyone. Kay Thompson here. Gus Henningberg is here. Millie Harris is here. And we're talking about the experiences of students of high school kids, children, period, whose parents are incarcerated. And we're talking about people who are doing things about it around the country. And we're talking about Millie Harris and her work at Central High School under one of her academies, which is the Social Justice Academy. Is that it?
Yeah.
Okay. What have you learned, you know, as a result of this kind of thing, knowing, of being, you know, did you come up with this portion of it and dealing with it the way that you're dealing with?
You mean my own personal experience?
Yeah. Yeah.
No.
No, I mean with the kids. Did you figure out your own, in other words, to get to them to open up?
How did you get them to open up? Yeah, the best way to get to the children to open up is to share your own experiences with them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I mean, the kids are by nature skeptics.
Yeah.
So once they realize that they can be comfortable with you, that they can be themselves with you, then they begin to share. And they begin to open up. And then you really also begin to see them shine.
Yeah.
Because they are amazingly resilient children.
Yeah, and they probably have been wanting to tell these experiences
for a long time
anyway.
I also want to mention, because you were talking about the New Jersey Performing Arts Center, and we have a partnership with them also. And just last week, our social justice dance and theater did a performance called Writing Myself into Being or something like that. It was poetry, dance, written, formed by the kids.
So
New Jersey PAC has proven to be a wonderful partner.
We're hearing music in the microphones right now, so I hope that everybody can hear us as we're trying to talk over the music, because this is really a fascinating subject. You know, some of the other things I want to talk about, you know, for instance, you know, I think I mentioned to you, or I talked earlier about kids who are going into college now.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is, you know, going a little further afield from what
you were
hearing about
all the music while we were
so,
talking.
But this one girl who said that she was, her father's black and her mother is Asian. Mm-hmm. And what the kids are doing now is deciding on the mixed, you know,
What they're
mixed kids.
Okay.
They are deciding what they should say about their backgrounds, whether they should be black, whether they should be Asian, whether they should be Indian, whether they should be white. You know, because if it's going to affect their college, getting into college.
She
was saying that she wants to say, she's going to say, I'm black.
Right.
And then that
for affirmative
may mean,
action.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, that may mean, she says, that may mean that she is really insulting her mother.
Right.
My words, not hers. But,
right,
you know,
right,
that was
right.
The gist of it in the paper.
Right.
Is it really interesting?
It is very interesting. When you're thinking in terms of social justice in a society that's so stratified and racial constructs and things of that nature, yes, it does become fascinating. And
it becomes so complicated now.
It is complicated.
That we never even dealt with yet.
And that we did not have to deal with. That's true.
Uh-huh. Okay, let's try again. This caller again. You are on the air. Hello. Hopefully we can.
Hi, this is Mama Soul. How are you?
Hi, I hear you, but I don't hear you. Can you say it again?
This is Nana Soul.
This is Nana Soul. Okay, Nana Soul, how are you?
I'm doing fantastic. Great job. You guys have a fantastic show. I'm really proud of you.
Fascinating show. Thank you very much. Thank
You're
you.
Welcome. I had a question actually for your guest because, you know, there are so
you
many disparities.
Okay, we're trying to hear you in here still.
Okay, can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yay! Okay.
I actually had a
question for your guest, Millie.
Yes.
Go right ahead.
So my question is, you know, there are a lot of disparaging remarks made about Newark in general, particularly the crime and the educational system out there. So hearing about this school that's doing so many fantastic things, especially towards social justice, what's the difference between working in a school with that kind of curriculum and, say, other public schools? And what's the problem? Why can't they seem to figure out the model that you guys have obviously figured out at the School for Social Justice?
Well, I think the difference is student engagement. I think that the students are very involved because these are matters that are very real to them and salient. I think that possibly one of the reasons that these techniques and models are not being used in other places is because, unfortunately, students are not necessarily the people with the largest voice when it comes to their education. So I would say that students are not being heard in terms of what they're saying that they need and they want. And the second least heard would be teachers who are, you know, in the trenches with the kids. And recognize that, you know, you need incentives. You need something to motivate you to learn. And if the learning is something that is applicable to your life and you see immediate results from it and it gives you a sense of agency, then you're empowered in many different ways.
You have really touched on the key word, motivating.
Right.
The kids have to want to come to school.
Absolutely.
They want to have a voice, but and right. teachers and educators, period, have to allow them to have that voice. And if you can get a student to the point where he trusts you enough to give himself to that teacher, because the teachers do have some involvement with it. Central High is a very unusual school. I think it's amazing. Yeah. It's amazing. Yeah. I know some of the teachers there. And what they do is really extraordinary. Because
well, we try
the
to do innovative
is,
things.
Yeah. Yeah. And plus you have a genuine, like, Kids can sense things,
oh,
as you know, I've taught, you know.
Absolutely.
And if you generally don't have a feeling of what they're feeling, or if you can't do that, you just maybe shouldn't be there.
Absolutely.
But the point is, it takes a lot. And teachers who do this, you know, are really, they're doing a huge job.
They are doing a wonderful job. So, and I can tell you that the people who have, what our project is for next year, we've been beginning to introduce some of it this year.
Yeah.
And, you know, people who come into the building in the middle of June are amazed at how engaged the students are. I mean, they are really, really on their grind and involved because of the nature of this project that we're doing.
Okay, you know, I want to give out the number for people to call. I think this is the number 323-679-0906. And you can call in on that number, callers, 323-679-0906. 323-679-0906. I almost want to say this is WLIB Radio. Guess what about you? You want to say this is Positively Black or something? That's right. We did talk to a lot of people. As a matter of fact, we had a segment called Police Report on.
Right.
And that was with Dr. Ali Al-Rahman.
Ooh.
And he had brought in police persons who were of the community, from the community, because people complained about certain police brutality issues, which were rampant at that particular time.
They're still rampant.
Yeah.
Don't get yourself.
Okay.
They're still rampant.
Okay. And, you know, we would have the police report, the police persons, and who were chosen by Dr. Ali Al-Rahman. And, you know, they would also tell people what to do. There was a civilian, what was that, the name of that, review board or something, that really people could not really completely count on at all. There was the Civilian Complaint Review Board. Mm-hmm. I remember giving out numbers and, you know, people calling and saying they weren't doing anything. And it was really very frustrating.
Right.
Because
and
there was so much happening at that review. There was the use of Hawkins case. Mm-hmm. There was, the Korean stores that happened, the Eleanor Bumpus case, the Mary Carson case, you name it, I can go down a whole list. But there was a kid who had schizophrenia.
Mm-hmm.
And instead of them treating this young man in a certain way, because I had the parents that came on talking about, you know, schizophrenia.
Right.
And they were saying that their children, their adult children, had to be treated in a certain way. This kid had ended up killed because of the fact that the police weren't trained enough. Eleanor Bumpus, for instance, the grandmother.
Right,
you know,
I remember
who was shotgunned
that.
Today? You know, that should
that
never have it never had happened. And I mentioned before last week about Reverend Dr. Herb Daughtry Guts over there in Brooklyn. He is still there with his church. He has this in his church, I'm assuming. I'm quite sure he's still there. But he had this wall of tears, which, you know, you saw killings of people by the police department.
By the police department.
You know, so, and...
Well, I wouldn't say it's quite
that
bad in New York right now,
but
yes, the kids will be the first to tell you that Yes, that they are treated differently by police officers. And interestingly enough, sometimes worse by black officers.
Yeah, yeah. So, but, you know, I'm not saying that we should come down on police officers.
No,
I don't want to get
no.
But I have heard of so many things.
But you have
to
be aware that people have rights, and they have to know their rights and exercise their rights.
Yeah. Well, we have 5 minutes left on this particular piece, and we're going to be keeping up with this. But right now, you know what? I want to let people know about Disappearing Voices, the Decline of Black Radio. This is a documentary. While not a complete history of black radio, the film offers the viewers a well-rounded discourse that touches on the impact of black jocks, not only on radio, but also on the very fabric of American life. And this film is by Black Wax, by the way, directed by Eusebio Washington. Now, this is replete with rare interviews with prominent figures in American society, like Melvin Van Peebles, the Reverend Al Sharpton, Chuck D of Public Enemy, Kay Thompson, the last poet, and so many other people with air checks by famous jocks like Frankie Hollywood Crocker. I knew Frankie. He was really something, I tell you. We know all the inside things. We're going to be revealing some of this, you know, when we get into the videos that we have of the different people. We're going to be showing these videos. The Dixie Drifters, Jocko Henderson, Hal Jackson, Eddie O.J. Okay. Disappearing Voices does more than examine the factors that contributed to black radio's demise, because it is, you know, just practically non-existent. It is an expose, a history lesson, and a memoir, and a source for solutions. And again, it's directed by Eusebio Washington, who is also the founder here of Black Wax. And I can't say enough about Black Wax, because they're the reason why we're here. So again, I'd like to say thanks to Ty, and like to say thanks to Ayana, to Tati, to Shauna, and everybody else who's involved here. And we are going to be going into another segment. I don't know how much time do we have. It's about 3 more minutes, but we're going to be going into another segment. This is going to be the segment involving Sahima's story. Remember, we started with Sahima last week, and Sahima was incarcerated in jail in the Philippines for 8 years because of the fact that she was she moved drugs. You know, she was a mule dealing with drugs, and she'll tell you when she gets here that she should have been incarcerated. She makes no bones about that. But I want her to continue with her story, because it's really, really, really fascinating. She survived 8 years. I think she was one person who was the longest American prisoner in a foreign country, but she'll tell that in part two of this. And the experiences that she had was really, really awful. And she has been told really all of it. So we're going to, talk to her about that and see what's going on. But I'd like to say, too, we have a lot of people who are supporting this. And one of the supporters and the supporters of the student, of this show, rather, A Closer Look, with Kay Thompson and Gus Henningberg, is Black Wax Records, to Jim Drury from Jimmy Cat. You know, they're supporting us also. And Don Scales. You know, I got a call from Don Scales, who is my cousin, who is in Iraq.
Ooh.
Yeah. And I'm supposed to say hello to Don Scales. Hi, young man. I hope everything is fine. And we'll be talking to you again. You're going to be coming back, right?
Oh, I have so much more to tell you.
I know. I want to hear all about it. You know, because whatever we can do, you know, for our kids, I don't care what it is, you know, to try to keep them...
keep them empowered.
Yeah, and we talked to Gus about it, you know, construction job. A lot of people don't have to go on to higher education.
Absolutely.
That may be desirable, but not everyone wants to go on to higher education.
It's just about going to gainful employment.
That's right. It's about, you know, being able to make money to survive.
And support your family.
You know, absolutely, absolutely. So what we're going to be doing is we're going to be coming back to you. We're going to be talking to Sahima, and hopefully, you know, her son, Hanif, is with her, so maybe we'll get to talk to Hanif. Gus Henningberg, we're going to be taking a break around about now, and we will be right back in case anybody wants to call in. I'm Kay Thompson with Gus Henningberg. Call this number, 323-679-0906. That's 323-679-0906. We'll be right back, everyone.